From South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Josh Heyer, and you're listening to the In the Moment News Podcast. Each week, In the Moment with Lori Walsh brings you news and arts coverage from across the state of South Dakota. Listen live at 11 a.m. Central, 10 Mountain on SDPB Radio, or tell your smart speaker, play SDPB. You can find every In the Moment segment at listen.sdpb.org or subscribe to the Segments Podcast. Now, the latest update from the South Dakota Department of Health shows one new case of COVID-19 in South Dakota. This brings the state's total positive tests to 9. The Secretary of Health says the new patient is a male in his 30s in McCook County. She adds all 9 patients have a history of travel outside of South Dakota within recent weeks. There is no evidence of community spread of the disease so far. Now, to prevent spreading of the disease, healthcare professionals encourage frequent hand washing, staying home if sick, and social distancing, especially for the elderly and those with underlying health conditions. So, on account of what's all going on with COVID-19, Governor Kristi Noem has declared an official state of emergency, which allows state agencies to accept funding or other resources to treat and stop the spread of COVID-19. The governor announced several other precautions, including statewide school closures. SDPB's Jackie Hendry has more.
Governor Noem is calling for all public K-12 schools to close next week. She's encouraging private schools to do the same.
I'm recommending that the schools use this time to clean their facilities and to prepare for the following week.
In addition, the governor is postponing all state basketball tournaments and all other extracurriculars. And in an executive order, she's calling on all non-essential state employees to work remotely. Friday morning, South Dakota Chief Justice David Gilbertson issued a judicial emergency, allowing circuit courts to take their own precautionary actions. Despite these measures, Governor Noem says the trends are encouraging. So far, none of the 9 cases of COVID-19 in South Dakota are a result of community transmission.
The things that we are implementing today and for the next week are proactive. We're going to make sure that we're keeping people safe, that we're making good decisions. Our schools will use this opportunity to clean their facilities and make sure that we continue the encouraging news and good trends, and that we also will make sure that we're doing due diligence when it comes to our court system, to our state employees, and then how we're bringing large events together.
New guidelines from the CDC also allow for single specimen testing for COVID-19 instead of 2 specimen testing, which the governor says effectively doubles the state's testing capacity. State Secretary of Health Kim Malsom-Risden adds another shipment of test kits are set to arrive in the coming days.
But again, providers have the testing equipment that they need and supplies, and the state health lab does as well.
The Department of Health will continue updating COVID-19 test results by noon each day through the weekend. For South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Jackie Hendry.
Now, as hard as it is to believe, about 15% of children in South Dakota are in the foster care system. More than 60% are Native American. Community organizers are working to create new foster homes for Native children with Native families. That way, kids are close to extended relatives and have access to their culture. SDPB's China Lockett reports.
When you walk in, you're walking into our big living room and communal area.
Hallie Riggs gives a tour of a house in the Simply Smiles Children's Village.
We have a big, beautiful kitchen that's being built. This is our kitchen island where kids will sit around and do homework together and cook together.
This is a new foster home for children on the Cheyenne River Reservation. Riggs is the clinical director for Simply Smiles.
The house is a 4-bedroom home. It'll house 6 children and our foster parents.
The nonprofit has collaborated with the reservation and the state's Department of Social Services on this project for 2 years. 2 Native American foster parents will live in the house with 6 kids, all under 18. The state pays the facility a daily rate for each child. Riggs says that money will cover housing costs, food, and provide a stipend for the foster parents.
The bottom line is that we know that especially in a difficult environment, in an isolated environment, your bandwidth is only so big. And so if it's being eaten up trying to worry about the everyday stresses of life and expenses, you're not going to have the energy to take care of kids who have high needs. So our mission is to make sure that parents aren't wanting for anything so that they can focus all of their efforts on the kids.
The kids will attend tribal schools. They can get counseling services at home to help them through trauma they may face. That's what Riggs is in charge of.
Social workers who are trained in trauma therapy to be able to help children, their foster parents, and their birth parents heal.
Simply Smiles was founded 17 years ago. It has some experience with children's services and has built three facilities in Mexico for indigenous kids. Two are run by local residents, and one is a collaboration with the organization, like the new home on Cheyenne River. The nonprofit has already done some community projects on the reservation, including gardens and after-school programs. Marcella Gilbert is a member of the tribe. She's been working with the program since 2017.
My mother, Madonna Thunderhawk, has been involved with child welfare issues for the last 10 years or so, working with tribes and trying to get the focus around what's happening in the state of South Dakota concerning Indian children being taken off our reservation and out of our home.
Gilbert introduced her mother to the organizers with Simply Smiles. She laughs as she talks about how the Mexican villages inspired her mother.
This is the result. You can't talk to my mom too long without her telling you what to do. This is what needs to happen.
The plan is to build 5 more group foster homes over the next few years. Based on state guidelines, that would let them create homes for 36 kids. The first house is scheduled to open this summer. Gilbert says representatives from other tribes have already asked about building their own children's villages.
We're creating something here that is very unique. It's a new model. We certainly don't know everything, because it's a new model. You know, I'm sure we're gonna stumble along the way, but that's how you make it work well.
The goal at Cheyenne River is to build a safe place for children. Gilbert says some of today's Lakota adults were forced into boarding schools as children and grew up without any examples of healthy parenting. Instead, they were often abused in the schools. She says that experience created dysfunctional dynamics for some Lakota families.
And so we have several generations of being removed from our Lakota parenting skills, parenting abilities. That's why it's important that we have more than just a mom and a dad. You gotta have the aunties, you gotta have the grandparents, the cousins, you know, everybody involved, because everybody has a role that protects everybody else in that family.
She says that only works when kids are kept on their reservation and close to extended family after they are taken out of their home.
For any child, no matter who they are, where they come from, they want to know that someone loves them and that those people who love them are going to take care of them and be there for them and guide them and, you know, do what needs to happen.
More than 40 years ago, the federal government created what's called the Indian Child Welfare Act. The law aims to keep Native children on their home reservation when they're in foster care. However, South Dakota has a shortage of foster parents in general and can't always follow that law when a family is in crisis and a child needs immediate care. The overall census population is roughly 20% Native and 80% non-Native. Despite that, more than 60% of children in foster care are Native. Those numbers show a clear need for new reservation foster homes. Chase Iron Eyes works with Oglala Lakota tribal leaders. For the past decade, he's focused on trying to improve the state's foster care services.
What we're dealing with is a situation, an expression, a symptom of that imposed foreign poverty environment. And we're being punished for it. We're actually having our kids taken for it.
Iron Eyes works with the Lakota People's Law Project to open foster homes across reservations in South Dakota. The most recent provides a home for 8 children in Standing Rock.
We need them to be 10 times bigger, and we need 100 of them on every reservation. Like, that's really what we need.
Now, Iron Eyes is working to create more homes on the Cheyenne River and Pine Ridge reservations. He says it's also important to bring in more Native adults as foster parents.
Every reservation wants these homes. They want even dorms. They want more, and there's a need.
Iron Eyes says even when a child is removed from their home, keeping them close to family connections and their culture can help them heal. For South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Chyna Lockett in Rapid City.
One of the confirmed cases of COVID-19 was an adult male in Pennington County. The man who tested positive for the disease died. But it's unknown whether the coronavirus was the cause of death. On Wednesday, Rapid City officials were meeting to discuss how they were planning to prepare. SDPB's John Wynn reports.
Many city and regional services are implementing different methods to curb the spread of the virus. Much of those efforts include deep cleaning and sanitization efforts. But for right now, officials are urging calm amid a growing number of COVID-19 cases. Rapid City Regional Airport Executive Director Patrick Dame says immediate airport traffic hasn't changed because of the virus.
Right now, we have not seen a necessary noticeable impact that is there. We haven't seen cancellations of flights. You know, obviously, there are some international pullbacks with flights that are going on. That could work either way on the domestic side, whether or not they increase domestic flying as a result of the changes that are there, or, you know, depending on how much the local U.S. Position is on that.
Dame says the airport sees many visitors, so those who are not feeling well should stay home. Shankar Kura is the vice president of medical affairs at Monument Health. He says health officials have been meeting daily since the outbreak.
We have a plan to isolate the case in the hospital. So initially, if there were just a single case, then we'd deal with that. If we exceeded a number, then we would actually have an entire unit designated.
Rapid City officials will continue to meet and assess emergency plans for the outbreak. For South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm John Wynn.
Our friends over at South Dakota News Watch ran a two-week-long investigative special on the livestock industry recently. You can find it online at sdnewswatch.org. According to the report, the state has seen a 15% rise in the number of CAFOs over the past decade. Bart Fancook says the stakes are high in terms of both risk and reward. He joined In the Moment host Lori Walsh to give an overview. Let's take a listen.
Bart Fancook, welcome back. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me, Lori.
We're going to hear some voices here in just a minute of folks that you talk to as you travel the state, finding out what CAFOs really are and what they aren't. But first, what can you tell us about the numbers of CAFOs in South Dakota? What did you learn?
Well, CAFOs are spread out across the state. The vast majority are on the I-29 corridor. In the east, there are some cattle ranches in the west that are permitted, but the majority of vast majority are in the East River part of the state. The hog industry is seeing the greatest growth, especially large hog farms where you're seeing larger confinements come online about one a month over the past 2 years, which is an increased pace compared to the past couple decades. You're also seeing somewhat of a boom in the dairy cattle industry in the Northeast due to some cheese-making expansions there. The AgriPure plant, for example, in Lake Norden tripled its production, needing 85,000 more dairy cows to be brought into the area. And what we're seeing overall is an increase, a shift of CAFOs from Iowa and southeastern Minnesota, where there's a feeling that they may not reach saturation, but they're getting to the point where they are running out of room. And so that is moving these CAFOs proposals and approval of those farms into South Dakota.
I want to jump in there real quick because you talked to a farmer, and I want to continue that Iowa conversation as we just heard from Art Cullen, who famously won a Pulitzer Prize for his editorial work exposing the pollution of the agribusiness industry in the state of Iowa. Farmers here in South Dakota have an awareness of what is going on in Iowa. That's not something they are ignorant to or surprised by. Tell me a little bit about Lyle Remnitz and your conversation with him, and set that clip up for us, please.
Yeah, Lyle lives about a quarter mile from a hog birthing CAFO in Davidson County, and he and some neighbors opposed the project. There were other neighbors who were investors in the project and are you know, we're able to get the permit for the project. It's a it's owned by the Pipestone company. That's a Minnesota firm formed by veterinarians who have created a system for raising hogs from birth to finishing, and they basically provide all of the infrastructure and the operations, and then local farmers run the farms. So he has a small farm there, and you know, he's had to change his plans about his life. He said that it's not every day when you can really smell it. The day I was there with him, there wasn't an overwhelming odor. But he said the biggest issue is with the gases that arise from the manure that is held on site basically throughout the year until it's pumped onto area farm fields every spring. And so I think the clip you have from him, he talks about what it's like to live nearby there, and when, especially when the winds blow in.
Well, when these gases come in, you start coughing, your eyes tear, and when it's really strong, your stomach starts to get upset. So, and I got some neighbors that get severe headaches from it when it comes in for them. So it's not a ideal situation, I don't want to see South Dakota become another Iowa, and I don't live over there, but what I hear is not good things coming from there. So we don't need all our rivers and streams polluted. And I know everybody wants cheap meat, but it comes at a terrible price to people that live here, in my opinion.
So, Bart, you mentioned, and again, folks can find all this work online at sdnewswatch.org, but you mentioned visiting farmers, visiting these operations. What are some of the things as you walked in these places and talked to people individually that maybe don't come across, in a print piece or an online copy? What the sights, the smells, and the emotions that are involved in this whole conversation?
Yeah, sure, Lori. I think the biggest takeaway for me is that these are really good people who really care about their communities, their properties, the land. I should say that farmers who are going to allow you in for an extensive visit at the kitchen table and a tour of the farm tend to be quality producers with great reputations. So that said, I did find them to be people who really cared about the animals and the way they were treated. I also noted, and they will tell you this, they all feel very beaten up on and demonized to some extent by people who are against either the environmental risks that exist or also the way that animals are treated there and use of antibiotics and those sort of things. So they do face a lot of blowback. But I could say that the hog farm I toured in Hand County, very, very clean inside. The animals don't like to do their business where they live. So there's an area where they are in pens, but they they're not wallowing in their own filth. The waste drop below them. And so they stand on concrete pads that are covered with sawdust. And they were generally very clean. I saw them early in the finishing process. But, but the bottom line is that farm in particular, great farmer, great guy, Matt Muller, he's well known in the industry. The smell, it was overwhelming. And after I spent, I was there twice. I spent one long day there when he was spreading the manure. I drove to Vermilion later that day from Hand County, the Miller area, and my coat stunk in the car the whole way. So it's a real, you do have, you're concentrating the wastes. I would say also, though, that I did meet with Brian Alderson. He's a beef cattle producer about 12 miles west of Sioux Falls, and he has a deep pit cattle barn. So he says that after he moved his cattle from an outdoor feedlot where they were subjected to rain and the wind and all the natural conditions, that when he brought them in and confined them in a barn and trapped the manure beneath them, that there was a dramatic reduction in smell. And I could say when I was standing there with him on a little platform 10 or 15 feet above all the cattle, it was amazingly, fresh. I didn't smell a lot of waste there. Right. So, there's two sides to every issue, and there certainly is to this one.
And you talked to farmer Brian Anderson, is it? Or
Alderson,
sorry, who said a lot of people have already made up their mind.
That's right. He went around and he really went, I think, to the nth degree in terms of preparing for this facility. He spent a lot of money, $1 million to build this barn that he actually, this is a secondary employment for him. He wanted to stay in farming, but he's also a crop adjuster for an insurance company. And he's also a former football lineman for USD who almost made it to the NFL. So he's very well known in that area. But I think in the clip he talks about how he tried to do what he could to assuage concerns of his neighbors before building the facility.
They all refused because they already knew what they were going to find. They were going to find a big stinky mess, and because that's what they were told it was going to be. Rather than coming and seeing it for themselves and experiencing it firsthand, they would rather just say no. You know, but now I don't think that there's one person that can say that their daily life has not gotten better in my local area because of this building versus my own side lots.
What's the future here, Bart? Because the future you mentioned in the piece that you wrote that or one of the articles that you wrote online, that the risks are high, and some of that has to do with neighbors and the relationships that we have. But the rewards for growth are also really great right now. Tell us a little bit about that and this last person we're going to hear from.
Yeah, you know, there has been some of the drawbacks are that the first of all, they're inspected. New CAFOs are inspected within the first 18 months, and then there are announced inspections by state regulators one to every 3 years after that, depending on the size. CAFOs have been the subject of about two complaints from the public per month over the past decade.
Are the inspections keeping up, Bart, because that was the problem Art Cullen said, is that in Iowa they just couldn't keep up with the number of inspections. That's not the case in South Dakota?
You know, it's hard to know. I don't think that they're behind in any large measure from what their goal is, but that's something that, you know, they'll have to keep an eye on if the number increases. But, you know, there's been about nine spills into state waterways in the past decade or so. So there's not a ton of problems. Those aren't really major spills, but, you know, there also have been, you know, violations of state regulations 217 times from 2009 to 2019, and $200,000 or so dollars in fines issued. So there's that. And on the flip side, one thing that I don't really think that's been talked about much is what a project can do for a community in terms of expanding jobs. I know that a recent Hand County project that was approved was going to create $1.3 million in payroll and another $1.3 million in annual feed purchases. So those farms do boost their local economies, and that's part of the trade-off. And I think that's where Christy Noem really sees a strong future for these, that they also allow for a very vibrant farming operation on a small piece of land. And so they do open the door for young farmers to, with a relatively minimal investment in equipment, not much investment beyond the buildings, to enter farming and stay in farming. And that's something I know she personally and politically feels very strongly about.
You also talked with the director of the Ag United Industry Group, Steve Dick. Tell me what he had to say again about this idea of permitting and inspection and how these things are being watched. They're not just going up in somebody's backyard without any oversight.
Yeah, you know, when you talk to Steve, he will point out that most of these farms, 98% of farms remain family operated and family owned. And, you know, he's aware of some of the risk that can happen from concentrating animals and their wastes. But I think he feels comfortable that South Dakota is well positioned to approve them and regulate them in a sensible way.
The day after COVID-19 popped up in South Dakota, we put out a one-hour-long podcast special, and you can find that in the playlist. So be sure to give that a listen. But our coverage didn't stop after the podcast. We still had more questions. Like, what if you're one of these people who's been asked to work from home, study from home, or communicate with loved ones from home? Does South Dakota have the online infrastructure to help the economy keep going during a pandemic? Well, we found the perfect guy to answer those questions. Jake Vandewater is the Vice President of Engineering, Operations, and IT at SDN Communications, and join Lori for this quick discussion.
Jake Vandewater, welcome. Thanks for being here today.
Thanks for having me, Lori.
Where do we begin talking about this? Where do you want to start with what exists in South Dakota already, maybe?
Yes, certainly it's a key issue that SDN worries about day in, day out. We're owned by the 17 independent phone companies of the state of South Dakota, and it's really, you know, internet, network capacity, network performance is really one of our forefront focuses, and we're looking at capacity as an ongoing basis. So we're not necessarily planning for the usage of tomorrow or next month. We're really looking out into next year. So we're doing the work now with our budget cycle and our network changes to really allow for peak usage that we expect to be coming in the future. And so that's really where we need to kind of start. And with a lot of the service providers is just focus on having that capacity in our networks, not just for the peak, but for the peaks that are they're expected, 6 and 12 months down the road.
Would you say that this is going to be an expected peak, though, because it seems like nobody could really predict or even now is 100% sure what's about to happen, how many people will be working from home in ways that they weren't before?
We're comparing it a lot to similar events that we're used to in South Dakota. You know, we always get that poor weather usage, those blizzard events, to where it changes where we see the peak. Maybe the usage doesn't change as much, but really the peak comes in a different time of day. Those usage patterns change. So it's really, I would compare it similar to that blizzard type event where schools are closed, people are working from home. You know, it's just creating kind of that usage change, and so we'll see a similarity with that. But by all means, it could certainly end up being a new peak for us this year, a lot earlier than the year than we may expect.
And here's a basic question, but does it shift? Because it seems like if 10 people are in an office and they're all using the internet in an office and they all go home and use the internet, how is that different? That would be, just explain to me how that might work.
Yeah, so it all depends on the functions and the usage patterns of that office. That office may be using a lot of cloud services. Microsoft has their online suite of tools, their Office 365. So if they're accessing those from the office and they're really just moving to home to access those, it really just is a similar usage. Now, it could be different from the standpoint of it all depends on how that home broadband network is set up. There may be bottlenecks that user encompasses along the way, to where it could be their own wireless network within their home. As the kids are watching Netflix, they're trying to maybe do a webinar or do some functions for work. It could certainly create a lot more usage within their home that maybe their home wasn't set up for, or even going beyond the home into that home broadband service provider, to where that's a shared network. And what that means is there's not a dedicated line going to their home necessarily. So if they're on that shared network and everybody within their home neighborhood is also working from home and changing the usage patterns there, there could certainly be bottlenecks there that create difficulties as well.
Mm. Are we seeing usage changes already? Has it started, or is it too soon in South Dakota?
Too soon. We really haven't seen any major changes. You know, as we see events that happen, whether that be an online streaming event or a weather event, we'll start to notice those, but we aren't seeing anything out of the norm just yet.
And staying on the topic of coronavirus, another big question that came up is how are we protecting the most vulnerable populations in the state? Nursing homes and long-term care facilities across the state are taking preventative measures to protect residents from infection with coronavirus. Randy Beery is the president of Good Samaritan Society, and joined Lori to talk about what they're doing.
Randy Beery, thanks for being here. Appreciate your time.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Tell us a little bit about Good Samaritan Society first and the scope of services that you provide in South Dakota. Let's start there, please.
Sure. Well, just over a year ago now, Good Samaritan actually merged with Sanford Health. So we're a totally owned division of Sanford Health. But the society as a standalone company, the Good Samaritan Society operates in 24 states, has about 270 facilities, with about 7,000 people in our skilled nursing and about 2,000 in assisted living. So it's a large national long-term care company with several facilities in South Dakota.
Where are those facilities located? All across the state? Or
across the state, yes. Three in Sioux Falls that maybe a lot of folks are familiar with. Three skilled facilities in Sioux Falls, and then several others scattered across the state all the way out to Rapid City, where we have a pretty significant operation.
All right, let's talk about a pandemic. And this is not something that is you're not starting from scratch from in a nursing home. Tell us how this preparation is sort of consistent with the things that you already do. And then let's talk about how it's a little bit different. So tell us a little bit about how every, you know, influenza season, just day-to-day operations, you worry about things like infectious diseases.
Sure. You know, the prevention of COVID-19, what you do to prevent it is, in that regard, it's very similar to the flu, and you do the same kind of, you know, you wash your hands, you stay home if you're sick, you try to distance yourself, you know, what they did refer to as social distancing. So the prevention side is similar. What is so very, very different is the impact of the virus. I mean, there's no vaccine, so nobody is out there carrying an immunity to it, so it spreads rapidly. And then especially among the elder population, just the deadliness of this disease. We believe it's running about 20% in a fatality rate in the elder population. So with no vaccine and no real treatment for it, that's what makes this so particularly dangerous and scary for long-term care.
How do you prepare then? Where do you begin, and what kinds of measures are important to be taking right now before we have cases in South Dakota, but we don't have as many as other states do. So we've had 7 weeks, I think, to really prepare. What are those preparations looking like?
You know, in preparation, I compare it almost to a professional athlete that even though they're professional, they keep practicing the basic skills. It's kind of like that for us. In preparation, it's just making absolutely sure you're following all the regular infection control practices and policies, and emphasizing, re-emphasizing. But then with this particular issue, you know, there's things because of the reasons I mentioned earlier. We're stocking up, making sure that we've got adequate supplies of things like infection control supplies and equipment. We're fortunate there that we're part of Sanford Health, so we've got a little deeper supply chain there to rely on. And then a couple of days ago, we took the action at the recommendation of our national professional organization, ACA, and we have now restricted visitors. The VA has taken a similar action in their long-term care facilities across the country, where we are prohibiting visitors. And we always, you know, it is a visitor ban. I mean, make no mistake. Yet at the same time, we also know that there will be unique circumstances. It might be an end-of-life type scenario or some unique situation that you can't even anticipate, where we would allow somebody in our building to go see their loved one. But we're really approaching it more from a ban, because that's the only way, that is the only way to protect people, is to keep them as isolated as we can and protected from this virus. And frankly, it's the quickest way for us to get over this as a country, as a nation, is to practice all of these things and social distancing. And of course, even in the last 24 hours, you've seen a lot of change there with the NBA suspending games, and now this morning closing the Capitol grounds in D.C. to visitors. And so those sound like drastic measures. And I guess compared to where we were a couple months ago, they are drastic. But it's the only thing. It's the only thing that is going to try to kind of what they describe as flattening the curve and mitigating now the virus. We're way past preventing it from getting into the country. Now we're just trying to deal with it.
Are there test kits available? Is it the same as for the rest of us? We're in a nursing home. If somebody's experiencing some kind of symptoms, you go through the South Dakota Department of Health? Or what is that process if a resident is demonstrating some kind of symptoms, or we know that they've been exposed to someone else with the virus?
That's exactly right. And we're really fortunate in the state of South Dakota, because the relationships between providers in this state and the Department of Health. I mean, basically, if you've lived in this state any amount of time, we all know each other personally. I mean, so you rely on those relationships. You rely on close communication, and we absolutely coordinate with the Department of Health, and we certainly would. Now, we're very lucky. You know, it's kind of a knock on wood. I mean, we have not had, and at this moment, we know of no positive cases in any of our facilities, and that's across the nation. But I think we'd be naive if we weren't preparing and anticipating the day when that'll change. And we will identify a positive COVID-19 resident in one of our facilities. But you're exactly correct. We will definitely work closely with the Department of Health.
You mentioned a ban on visitors, but many of these people are assisted living, or you know, they're allowed to leave and come back, sometimes in a group activity, or sometimes just, they have their own cars and they can go somewhere. Is there any kind of ban on leaving or request for people to stay put?
No, and I'm really glad you brought that up, because that's an important distinction, and I kind of fall into the trap sometimes. I talk about visitation bans and things like it's everywhere. The visitor restriction is specific to our skilled nursing, or what most people refer to just as your traditional nursing home.
Right.
For assisted living, that is not in place, visitor restrictions. Now, because as you said, these folks are fairly independent, and it's more of a residence for them. But we are giving them the same guidance, and we are very much discouraging visitation and trying to limit it, try to give people the facts and kind of having a self-enforcement. Because, again, if you wanted to take the most conservative approach, I will tell you, if I had a parent in assisted living today, because just by definition, that typically means it's a more elderly individual that perhaps has some medical conditions. If I had a family member in assisted living, I would not want them out traveling in the community, and I would not want them receiving visitors that weren't a really essential part of their daily life, because it's just, again, it goes back to trying to limit the spread of this virus.
What does quarantine look like in a nursing home? Is that something that you're sort of already set up to do, or would people have to move to different rooms in a facility?
No.
How are you prepared for that? Yeah.
Yeah, it's when we say, you know, no visitors and those things, life within the building doesn't change a whole lot. I mean, they're all in their same room, and their same group of residents. Usually those become communities. You know, they all know each other. They're friends.
Right. I meant if you had somebody who had symptoms and they needed to wait for a test result, for example, what would what would happen then? Yeah.
That's a very specific policy. If somebody tested positive, if they became ill to a point where they needed, you know, further care, obviously we take them to a hospital.
Right.
What they're encouraging us, which I think is good policy, is that if they test positive, but they're not exhibiting symptoms that require any kind of hospitalization, they're asking us to treat them in place, which is a good idea, because if we don't do that and we just simply start shipping everybody to the hospital that's positive, we're going to overrun the hospitals in all mm-hmm. likelihood. So we've got very specific protocols around. We would move them to a private room. We would keep the door shut. We'd limit the number of caregivers going in and out of that room. We would practice basically isolation type procedures with that resident. And so, yes, what you're describing is basically almost like a quarantine within the facility.
Right. And staff have already been trained for that. They have the personal protective gear. How do you protect your staff members?
Well, that's a concern. I mean, today, sitting here today, I can tell you, you know, we've got adequate supplies and equipment. The concern, of course, is that if the entire country starts, you know, having positive cases that need either hospitalization or, you know, taking care of them in place in facilities, that's going to get difficult to do. Now, I can tell you, just a week ago yesterday, I was invited with a small group from long-term care to meet with Vice President Pence. And one of the things, and he wanted to know what our concerns were. One of the high concerns we lifted up was the exact question you just asked. I don't think we'll have a countrywide so much a shortage of equipment and supplies, but it'll be a location shortage. If a location has today suddenly identified two or three residents that were positive and went to an enhanced infection control level, they will go through their supplies a lot more rapidly than they normally do. And in that case, we're going to need to have a supply chain that can keep them supplied. And if that starts happening around the country, the federal government may need to step in through executive orders and start mandating where some supplies are going to be taken to get them to the area of need. The vice president was very open to that concept. He understood the concern. And so there again, we're trying to be proactive, I think, in our approach to this.
Have you ever had anything like this before that you can hearken it to? And have we learned anything from how this coronavirus and COVID-19 is playing out in China or South Korea or Italy? Like, are we looking to other nations or to our own history for lessons learned?
Well, I think our own history is a guide. I've been in the business long enough where, you know, I've been through the H1N1 virus, the Ebola situation a few years ago. And this feels similar to that. And we're using a lot of the lessons learned in terms of setting up incident command and communication structures real quick and early to make sure we're all connected as a system. So those lessons learned, I think, are good ones that we're benefiting from. But this feels different. We're a little bit in uncharted ground here, too, when you just look at the magnitude of it from a global perspective. And the things that, as you mentioned, you know, when an entire country of Italy is basically quarantined and travel is banned from Europe and the stock market is closed, the capital is closed to tourists, the NBA suspends, you know, on and on and on. This does feel different in terms of size and scope than what we've experienced before.
I was reading a story about what's happening in Italy the other day and the choices that they're having to make about who to treat because of lack of equipment and lack of services. We want to believe that that cannot happen here, that America is more prepared and more organized than that. But it's hard to get our minds around whether or not any system could be overrun. How do you help people walk that line between preparing, having a sense of urgency, taking it really seriously, taking this social distancing seriously, even though it's so disruptive to our daily, you know, way of being in the world, but also not to panic and really go to worst case, because that can cause anxiety for elderly people, for people who love their elders in nursing homes. It really can keep you up at night as well. So where do you sort of split that hair for people?
You know, that's exactly the balancing act that we walk, because on the one hand, you know, you don't want to incite panic or make it sound like, you know, this is the end of civilization.
Right.
Because, you know, the other reality here in the infectious disease, people will all tell you this. I mean, this is going to, just like we're seeing in China, this is going to peak in the U.S. It's going to peak and then it's going to start going down and we'll manage our way through this. I mean, it's not going to go on and on and on and on. That's not how these viruses work. So, but right now, you also have to communicate and be very serious about social distancing and some of these things, because what they talk about in the infectious disease world is, you know, flattening that peak, you know, flattening the curve so that we don't spike way up there like Italy did, so that by taking the actions that we're doing today in banning visitors, in not having the NCAA tournament, we're trying to flatten the curve so that we don't overrun our health system, so that as much as possible, limit the number of positive cases and the number of deaths so that we don't overrun the system. And quite honestly, this is an issue that one day makes a big impact. So, I mean, the quicker, the faster than this next few days, the next week, the actions we take now will determine how long this runs its course.
Talk a little bit before I let you go about when you're in a nursing home or assisted living, in a skilled nursing facility or assisted living, there is a disruption to the way daily things are done. Things are canceled. Your family can't come see you. You're worried about things. What's the role of an activities director or a chaplain, or how do you sort of help people deal with the emotional turmoil that can lay on top of other ongoing health problems and concerns about end-of-life issues? Who are those people who are kind of doing that sort of unsung work right now in Good Sam facilities?
Well, I think you've hit on a real important part. I sit in a corporate office and I do interviews and I, you know, go to meetings. But it's clearly the staff that are on the front line of this issue. And they're the ones that are bearing the brunt of the virus. And they're the ones talking to family members, comforting each other, comforting the families, comforting the residents. And we just had a discussion with this at our incident command meeting in the last couple of hours. And we brought in Pastor Greg Wilcox, who's the head of our mission integration team here for Good Samaritan. And I feel very fortunate because Good Samaritans had a long history of a faith-based background. And so we have embedded in our facilities, you know, the easy access to a chaplain, if that's what you need, or, you know, to those kind of resources for the exact reason that you talked about. I mean, this is going to be it's going to be so stressful on a variety of people involved, as you mentioned, that it's the staff, but it's the families, it's the residents. And the more we can have people in place to provide comfort, give assurance, let people know we're doing all that we can, we talked in our last meeting about we focus on operations and tackling all these operational issues. And so many of us in our backgrounds, we come from such operational backgrounds that sometimes we lose sight of that. And Pastor Wilcox is going to sit in on every one of our daily incident command meetings now going forward, just to bring that perspective and make sure we don't lose sight of it.
That's the show for this week. Thank you for joining us. If you're looking for an individual segment from our radio program, you can find all of our segments at listen.sdpb.org or by following the In the Moment Segments podcast. If you have a story idea, send an email to inthemoment@sdpb.org. For Lori Walsh, Steve Zwemke, and Chris Loffrey, I'm Josh Heyer. Wash your hands. Thanks for listening.